Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're speaking with Chris and Rachel Theodore from Sea Urchin Harvest in Tomakan on the New South Wales South Coast. We chat about how they built their business, the realities of being a sea urchin diver, and about how these sea urchins are destroying marine ecosystems. Here we go. Let's get started. All right, welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. By myself, Steph Postuma, as your host. Simon Evans is in Wollongong trying to figure out what he's going to do with his restaurants at the moment, selling takeaway dumplings and things like that from his wine bar. And I find myself down here in Browley speaking with some local sea urchin fisher people, Rachel and Chris Theodore. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
No worries. Ed, what do we call you? Do we call you fisher people? What's your titles?
I guess so. Fisherman processors.
Yep. Perfect.
Yep.
Commercial sea urchin.
Sea urchin harvest.
The sea urchin harvest is the name of your company, isn't it?
Yep. Oh, just sea urchin harvest.
Sea urchin harvest. Okay, fantastic. All right. Well, as we find ourselves down here on the south coast in Browley, and as we travel around with this podcast, we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where we are. So we'd like to acknowledge the Eora Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land of this area, and acknowledge elders past, present, and emerging. Okay, well, let's start. Why did you become a sea urchin fisherman? How did it start?
I'm actually a second generation abalone diver. So I've been abalone diving for about 20 years. And I just used to curse them and hate them with a vengeance and passion.
The urchins?
Yeah, the urchins, because they take over all the abalone grounds. And there's about 1,000 urchins to every one abalone. And they just get stuck in your knuckles. And So I was doing that for 10 years. And then there was a small producer local here. And I started doing a bit of diving for him. But wasn't too reliable and stuff, the work. So I started playing with the idea of sort of starting a small factory myself and approached council. We had a bit of land and stuff. And we got the go ahead from council and decided we'd do it and build a small factory and started from there.
Yeah, right. Did you notice, sort of as an abalone diver, did you notice that there was an opportunity, there was an increasing interest in sea urchins, like in the market? And feel free to jump in too, Rachel, and you wanted to sort of capitalise on an opportunity or...?
Kind of. I knew there was a market there, but I wasn't sure the size of it really. It started out very small and it's taken us 10 years to sort of build the market up to where we need it to be to be properly profitable.
Mm.
Yeah, it was very slow start. Took a lot of word of mouth to by the time the word got around. It's a very select customers.
Mm.
It's not just your local general store generally.
But and working with customers really.
Yeah. So we work real personalised with customers.
Mm.
Yep.
And so it's been 10 years, has it?
Yeah. We've been operating for 10 years.
Yeah.
It was a long, hard road because it wasn't even a viable market when we started. Our families pretty much supported us while we drove ahead with our vision of what we could see, what it could be. But now we're well established and, we're doing well now.
Mm. If I think back to 10 years ago where I was probably still working in kitchens back there, and really only very few. You'd probably only see urchin on the menu at Japanese restaurants back then.
Yeah.
Not so much other places, and I doubt anyone was, apart from maybe some Kiwis and, you know, some other, you know, members of our ethnic community would be buying things like urchins to have at home.
Yeah, for sure. No, yeah. It was definitely very, it's definitely boomed in the last sort of 5 years, a lot more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk a bit about what you guys actually sort of do on a day-to-day basis. Do you want to tell us a bit about, Rachel, the types of urchins that you harvest?
Oh, we do two kinds, but the main one is the Centro sea urchin. That's okay. The one most people would see when they go snorkeling.
Yep.
With the really long black spines.
Mm-hmm.
So they're right from Sydney right down to Tassie.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite prolific. And then in winter, we do a white urchin, which we harvest from Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
That's just to get us through. It's a lot harder, the white urchin, even though the flavour's very rich and sought after. For the divers, it's not like a pest like the Centro, so they've really got to hunt for them.
Mm.
And they've got to go a long way down the coast, so it's a lot more dangerous.
Mm.
And then to harvest them, the roe's a lot smaller, so it's a lot harder for the processors. It's a long day.
Mm.
So we probably do them for 2 months, and then we're straight back into the Centros again.
Yep.
That's our main urchin.
And so is that just sort of a factor of the seasonality of the different urchins?
Yes.
So what are the seasons?
So for Centro, typically people would have said December to May. We've managed to create other products and get much better at where we harvest, at what time of year. So we've stretched that out to maybe August.
Okay.
So we'll do the Centros starting even November right through till August. Then we'll do the white urchin for a couple of months, and then we'll keep testing the Centros, and when we think they're ready to go, off we go again.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a bit about how licensing works? I know that with the abalone industry, licenses are very limited and they're very valuable. What was it like applying for your first urchin license, or when you applied for your urchin license?
There's licenses in New South Wales. They have one attached to every abalone license.
Right.
Yeah, in the last... it was a while ago they separated them so you could sell them off as a separate license. So there's roughly 30 or so in New South Wales licenses out there. And so to get one, you've got to purchase one off someone willing to sell one.
Right. So it's like, the abalone license.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. But yeah, a lot less valuable.
Right. Okay. So you just go through that process. But licenses are still limited. Why? I mean, we'll talk about, the proliferation of Centro urchins in a little bit later on in the podcast and the way that they're affecting the marine ecosystem. But do you see a good reason, Rachel, as to why they cap the amount of licenses? I mean, to that 30 number?
Well, it is a fishery.
Yeah.
And like all fish, it is best to monitor it. So with the Centro, there's no quota, but we do say how much we catch. So the fisheries are getting an idea.
Right.
You know, they're collecting history on the catch, which I think is really important.
Mm.
I think New South Wales is run much better than Victoria in that respect. There's no quota.
Yeah, I didn't realise there wasn't a quota, so that does make sense. Yeah.
For other species of sea urchin, there are quotas because they're needed.
Yeah.
They're not a pest, but for the Centro, they are just taking over. There's actually no way really to control them. Their numbers are that big now.
Mm.
But the fisheries do take that information, which I think is important. Whereas Victoria, Chris can tell you, it's a completely opposite story, and it is actually very frustrating for processors.
Yeah, they've kind of quoted it down in Victoria and they only got limited licenses, and so it's a massive resource there, but it's quoted, so we sort of have a bit of trouble getting extra fish out of the water. We run in a quota with certain divers and stuff that are able to do it at the time, and it gets quite hard. You need to be quite skilled to be the diver. You need proper equipment, boats and all the diving gear, all the experience necessary. You got to be very selective when you pick the urchins up and stuff, and from which spots and stuff like that.
All right. Well, let's talk about that. Let's do a little day in the life of an urchin diver kind of thing, because I think it's fascinating. So can you give us firstly an idea of what sort of equipment you use? I mean, starting from, you know, the boat, I guess.
Yeah, well, I've just finally got a new boat, which is a bit bigger. It's up to a 7.5 metre formula boat. The last boat I was using was 6 metre. We could fit about 30 bins in that, but now we can fit about 50 bins, sorry, in the new boat. Since that takes like probably 5 hours diving,
right? And so, how many urchins would go in one bin?
20 to 25 kilo.
Yeah, okay, yeah, right. Yeah.
So that might be up to a ton of product.
Yep.
Yeah, and so they're quite easy. You can get them quite quickly when you know what you're doing in the right spots and stuff.
Well, that's the thing about urchins as compared to a lot of other, you know, fisheries or industries, production industries, where you're taking from the environment, is that they're absolutely everywhere, aren't they?
Really. That's right. There's a lot of spots where they're no good. Where usually if you go to a spot where there's too many, there you'll find they're not so good.
And right.
Because they haven't got much feed, they're competing for feed so much that they'll stay skinny.
Right, okay. But,
and also the flavour's not there.
Yeah, you lose the flavour, they get really old and they're not so good. So we're finding the spots that we continually keep harvesting seem to be the best.
Okay.
The roe's much fresher and they're younger urchins and they're producing better. They've got more food.
Yeah, cool. And then so... But you're literally sort of, as you said, up to 5 hours or something like that. Are you in the water for 5 hours?
Yeah, so you do 5 hours in the water.
5 hours a day underwater.
Yeah. You're collecting like 40 kilo every 10 minutes. So you're carting a big bag around. You'd say it's like a metre long by a metre round.
Wow.
Parachute and, yeah.
And the big hook.
Yeah, you got a big hook and you hook them all in there. And they're every single one of them's wedged into a rock. They hold on quite tight, so they're very hard to remove from the rocks.
Yeah. And so are you walking on the bottom?
No. You're finning? Swimming around, yeah. So we have a parachute to help hold the weight of the bag up and then we sort of just put that under your shoulder and cart it everywhere and, yeah, just go to the cracks and scoop them all in.
You're swimming around. And I mean, what's it like spending 5 hours of your day underwater? Does it sort of feel like you live half on land, half underwater?
Yeah,
you feel
like I used to describe it like being hit by a truck when you get out on the next day. Yeah, it was like, really, it's quite physical.
I'm sure.
But it's hard work. But it's nice. You got to love it or you'd hate it. There's a lot of people that think they can do it, and when they actually try it, they realise how demanding it is.
And you're on obviously you can't be on tanks that you take under with you, so it's like an oxygen line that goes up to the boat.
Yeah, that's right. We've got an airline running from the boat. Yeah, so the boat will just follow me around all day with the deckhand because you cover quite a bit of ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to know how many kilometers you do underwater each day.
Yeah,
you need some sort of tracker, but
little underwater Fitbit for how far you could probably do that with some sort of GPS.
Yeah, maybe.
It'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
And the decky, it depends on the decky.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, how hard his day is.
Oh, really?
The deckies, they've really got their job work cut out for them too. Like, if I'm really onto them, I can be sending them up every 10 minutes. So by the time they winch the bag up, put the bag into the bins, stack the bins, tie the bag, put the bag on the hose, all at the same time as keeping the bait off the rocks, keeping the hose loose for me.
If
they got 20 knots of wind on it as well, I thought they're very busy.
So what, and you guys have pretty sort of like robust boats that can manage like some pretty serious conditions.
Yeah, the boat I've just set up now is probably $100,000 worth to be able to just, because we're sort of limited to what days we can work, so we can't really wait for weather.
Mm.
We have to work sort of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday to be able to get it to market before the weekend because it's only got a short shelf life. So, yeah, we need some pretty serious boats to be able to handle the weather and then carry the weight.
Yeah, so you're sort of underwater in all sorts of conditions.
You dive some horrible conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah, with abalone, you can sort of pick the better days a lot more. But, with the sea urchins, like I say, you need to get it to market every week, so you got to work the start of the week. No matter what the weather is.
Yeah. And what sort of a toll does being underwater for 5 hours a day for a few days in a row sort of like take on you physically?
It's very hard. By the end of 3 or 4 days, you're just like a zombie. It's like you've got a hangover all the next day when you finally do have a day off, and sometimes it'll take 2 days to recover.
Yeah. And is there any sort of physiological things with, in terms of just being on an oxygen line, being underwater, the pressures and things like that that have an effect on you?
Yeah, with the urchins, they're sort of lot easier than the abalone. They're in a shallower water, so I tend to be in around 8 metres.
Okay.
So there's not really any risk of the bends in that sort of depth. Mm. So you can sort of stay down there all day. With abalone, you're going up to 15 to 20 at times. So that's where you got to worry about the bends.
Mm.
But, yeah, just the stresses it puts on your body, pushing that bag through the water and pulling the hose and getting the urchins off it, it's just really hard on all your joints.
Mm. I mean, you must have get spined a fair bit and things like
You get good at it, so you don't get spined. Yeah, you get used to handling them. But as soon as you let your concentration slip, sure enough. Yeah.
And what about sort of that salt water effect on your skin and things like that? Do you have to take care of your body, like the wetsuits that you wear?
You need good quality wetsuits. They're very sort of soft rubber these days. They're quite good.
You're lucky your brother makes them.
Yeah, my brother produces them.
What's the name of the wetsuits?
Black lip
wetsuits.
They're really good suits. And
so they're commercial diver wetsuits.
Yeah, he does spearfishing suits and commercial diving suits. And
and can people get them?
Yeah. So you just Google black lip wetsuits and.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's got them online.
Shout out to Blacklit. I actually need a new diving wetsuit.
Sandra's got one. It's really good.
I'll check it out. I was diving yesterday and I've got all sorts of holes. I'm still running a surf wetsuit while I'm out in the water a lot of the time. So anyway, Blacklit. Okay, cool. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about... Actually, let's talk about where you fish. So we're here in Browlie, which is sort of 15 minutes south of Batemans Bay, if you have never heard of it out there. What's the sort of range where you guys...
Yeah, so that's kind of what got me into it as well. I do abalone diving, so I have to travel to Mallacoota a lot to do my work down there, and I get sick of traveling and stuff. So I knew all the urchins were right here at my doorstep, and that was me sort of drive behind doing urchins.
And we had a young family.
So. Yeah, so... It's good to be able to stay at home and not to have to travel all the time. And because, Mallacoota is like the best spot in Australia for abalone, whereas the up here, it's not quite so good. But the urchins up here are just as good as Mallacoota. So it's like having Mallacoota at my doorstep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I just sort of dive out here quite a lot between Narooma and Browlie, basically.
Yep.
I can pretty much pull as much as I want out of there every year.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I mean, and like what you just said, from Narooma to Browlie is a huge bit of coastline, and as you said, you can get as many as you like.
Yeah.
From that one area right on your doorstep.
Well, and I've just seen the amazing bit is how well it comes back after you harvest them areas where the kelp was nearly getting pushed right back. It's grown up to 2 metres tall in spots and that now, where it's
really
harvested all the urchins out and thinned them out a lot.
Right, and so how long has that taken?
I reckon 2 or 3 years you start to really notice a big difference.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've got a ground of essentially, void of plant life on the seabed and things where you harvest your urchin.
Yeah, that's right. So there's
from.
Sort of an edge there's usually an edge where the surf breaks and that controls the urchins there, so the kelp can stay there.
Yeah.
So we'll work that edge, and then you grow that edge, and it increasingly goes out wider and wider.
Yeah, right.
Out into deeper water.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'll talk about it in a moment, but, I mean, in terms of sustainable fisheries and sustainable production, to be able to actually benefit the environment by taking these animals from the environment is amazing. And it's a sustainability factor that not many other industries have.
Yeah, I think it's probably one of the most sustainable seafood industries in the world, really.
Yeah.
Especially the ones in New South Wales, the Centro, because they're such a plague proportions, 80% of them are no good for harvest anyhow, so you can never overfish it.
Yep.
Yeah. And they're very fast growing. They come back very quickly. And
so what makes that vast proportion of them not being good for harvest, Rachel?
No food.
Right.
They eat themselves into a barren, so it's white rock.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So that's where Chris is saying he's working along the weed line. They're the best urchins because they're well fed. They've got all those nutrients.
Okay.
They're going to be sweeter and creamier, whereas, you head into the barrens and you can crack one open, you can tell the difference straight away.
Right. So it's just not as thick, plump roe, fatty
exactly.
roe.
Yeah.
And not as tasty, obviously, on the
other
end.
Yeah, yeah. And they can exist like that for like 10 years plus, they reckon.
Just on a rock.
Just sitting in a rock, and they'll actually eat the rock. So I don't know if you've ever dived under and you've seen the urchin sort of sitting in a little bit of a hole.
I was doing that yesterday and I was looking around. We were sort of, where were we? Off Pretty Point, I think, just over near Tomakan, and near Gorilla Bay. And I was looking around and every single urchin was in a hole that was shaped like an urchin.
Yeah. Yeah. It's eaten that hole.
It's eaten into the rock.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're crazy. Their teeth are just so hardcore. Well, wow. I don't know if they're called teeth, but whatever they're called.
Yeah. Beak. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, when you hear that chattering underwater, that's actually all the urchins chomping away on the...
On the rock.
On the rock, yeah.
Wow.
We actually listened to a podcast and the lady recorded that. I don't know if you've heard that one.
Yeah, I know the sound that you're talking about, but amazing. A rock. I wonder what sort of nutrients are they getting from the rock? Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. Whether they're eating it or they just sort of chewing
minerals
it to make
in
a
there.
Home, maybe. Or, maybe. I'm not sure.
That's interesting. It'd be interesting for someone to have a look at.
So so Pretty Point, that's the marine park too, isn't it?
Yeah, so the New South Wales fisheries actually have a sanctuary there, so you can't actually take purple urchin out of Pretty Point.
If you can believe they won't let us harvest them.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that in a second. We'll get to what they're doing on the ecosystem in a second. But let's talk a bit about your processing facility first. It's in Tomakin, yeah?
Yeah, yep. So we have 5 acres.
Yeah.
So we've built a processing facility there.
Right. And I mean, urchin, I think having experience in processing different types of fish and abalone and lobsters and all that sort of stuff, urchin's a bloody hard thing to process. It's so delicate. And, you know, in terms of the sort of weight to yield ratio in an urchin, it's not high. You know, there's only 5 tons.
Yeah, so we're talking small percentages. So you can go from 4% recovery. That's the base viable rate.
Right.
Yeah, so you might go up to 8%.
Yeah,
8% recovery is a good rate.
And so did you, at the beginning of the 10 years, I assume that around here there wasn't a really established processing system. Did you guys have to sort of develop that over the years and fine-tune it and things like that yourself?
Yeah, for sure. We're still learning.
Right.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me anyway.
Yeah.
Continually Googling and it's very secretive. Nobody wants to...
Really?
Yeah, no one wants to tell you how they do
it. I won't ask you too many questions then about it. But you've had to sort of, create a system that works for you guys.
And just I think that's where working with the customers really closely has helped.
Okay.
So even today, we'll ring people, say, "How'd you go this week? What was the feedback?" And that's how each week then I'd go back to the team and say, you know, they said this and this, so let's try and solve this problem.
Yep.
And that's how we still operate today. And that's how we grew the business, just by working really closely with the customers and giving them exactly what they want.
Mm. And so how many, and you said earlier before we started, you got about 15 people processing in the factory at any given day?
So before COVID-19, 15, 16 people, just processors literally. And then we have a team of divers to draw from, about 5.
Okay.
Which then is in 5 deckhands. And then we also have a freight driver. So
right.
We employ quite, for a small business, we employ a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's the nature of it being so labour intensive. It'd be hard to find another food as labour intensive as sea urchin roe, and that's reflected in the price for the consumer. Our main focus is, you know, getting it from the diver, and literally the next day it will get processed and shipped. That's what we've based our whole business on.
Because it's quite a like the roe is so delicate. I've found that if I have, because I sometimes mess around with recipes with, you know, urchin myself here, and if you leave it for a day or two, they just sort of degrade and go a bit sloppy, and you wouldn't want to be selling something.
Yeah,
like
that's
that,
right. So there's definitely a technique that we've learnt to help give it the extra shelf life.
Yep.
And that's all, you know, for all seafood, time and temperature is key.
Mm.
And that's what we follow. But yeah, I mean, straight out of the shell is always best.
Mm.
You know, if you're able to get out there and go for a dive, that's the best way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so as you mentioned, getting that system of processing right, you know, was helped developed by direct communication with the customer. Who are your main customers?
Just Australia-wide, we sell direct to private people, the restaurants, the wholesalers. I can't remember how many.
So you sell direct to restaurants?
Yeah.
And
okay. And also endless phone calls and letters that I write to overseas companies hoping one of them will reply and give me some help. Yeah, I just always trying to talk to as many people as possible to find out more information, how we've come to where we are today.
Mm-hmm. And so you and you've got a, as you said, you've got a freight driver as well. So before the weekend, you send a truck, I assume, up north to sort of deliver.
Yeah, we use Qantas Freight, the couriers, the freight guy. He's the guy who picks them up. Our truck driver, I should say, he'll go down the coast and pick up urchins and bring them back to the factory that night. Yeah, that's how we ship to everyone by the next day.
Yeah, and can you give us an example? Is there, I mean, as we said, maybe there's a bit of a secrecy behind some of this, but can you give me an example of some feedback a customer might have had that has allowed you to sort of adapt and improve the way you deliver your product?
So a comment might be, it's a bit bitter. So yep. Maybe we haven't controlled the temperature properly there.
Okay.
It's a bit wet. So maybe we haven't left it to dry long enough. I'm talking about the premium product.
Mm-hmm.
There's different products. So when that happens, I go back to the team and we just all talk about it and we taste and work it out.
And tell us a bit about the different products you guys offer.
So we've got the premium product, which is the most popular with the Asian market, and it's the uni trays.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you've ever seen them.
Yeah.
Some are in wooden boxes, some are in plastic trays, but they're literally just the most perfect pieces of roe, picked clean, dried, packaged. Yeah.
Yeah. And how... You have to sort of grade as you process in a way.
There's grades that we do,
right?
And different customers want it different ways. You know, not every customer or restaurant wants the highest grade because they might be going to cook with it, so they might, you know, want the B grade.
Okay.
And then other products we've come up with sort of to get more price point are some creamy pods that we've just started doing, and they're just starting to take off.
So what are they?
They're literally still the fresh sea urchin roe. They're like the broken pieces that didn't quite make the grade for uni.
Yeah.
But we put them in like a little pod, has a little spoon under the lid, so they're perfect for like a snack. But then you can also use them through fried rice, any cooking you want, putting on top of your soup. Yes.
Have you, through communication with your customers, learned a lot about how to prepare them, how to cook them and things like that?
Yeah, of course, because we don't cook, like, you know, Australians aren't big sea urchin eaters.
Yeah, well, I guess that's an interesting thing to talk about. Like, what maybe 10 years ago when you first started, who were your customers back then? Like,
literally just the Chinese, Japanese and the kina for the lower grade. There was only like two grades.
Mm-hmm.
As sea urchins become more popular and more knowledge and people have developed a taste for it, just like they would oysters or caviar, that's where we're starting to see it go more like overseas, where there's the different grades of sea urchin roe and different products and more and more chefs using it. So you're seeing more and more ways that it can be used. So it gives you more ideas of how can we create more products for them.
Yeah, fantastic. I definitely noticed from being someone that follows a lot of restaurants and chefs and things like that on Instagram that so many more chefs are using it in lots of different types of restaurants. It's not necessarily in Asian cooking or anything like that. It's
just the local chef in the Bay had a sea urchin ice cream as a starter.
Really?
Tinker.
Yeah.
It was so good.
At what restaurant?
Really Sandbar restaurant.
At Sandbar, right, yeah.
That was crazy.
Did you guys have a try of it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
A few times. We love Sandbar.
Yeah. And do you guys eat a lot of urchin?
Not really. I suppose on my day-to-day, we'll have... Because we taste it every day.
Yeah,
like
okay,
any
right.
Chef tastes their food, but...
Yeah, I wouldn't eat it like I eat prawns and oysters and stuff.
But I think that, like...
But it's the kind of thing that, you know, people either love it or they don't like it at all sort of thing. It's not really... The people that love it just absolutely love it. They just can't get enough.
Well, that's it. I think that more and more people are beginning to view urchin like oysters in a way that you just eat them whole and you just eat them raw and they're a part of a cold seafood platter like oysters and prawns.
Yeah,
and that sort
of thing. When you see where you're getting them and diving from, it's such a pristine, pretty area and the kelp and the bottom's all so nice. You can see why they're such a high quality seafood.
Mm. Well, that's it. And I think that, you know, one of the things that people love so much about oysters is that they're really connected to the environment in which they're grown. And it's exactly the same for urchins.
Yeah, urchins definitely taste more like the ocean than any other seafood, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I mean, the fact that they're eggs, you eat the eggs, they've got that eggy creaminess, but then that same sort of ocean salinity.
For sure.
It's pretty delicious. And I think that they're much more versatile in cooking that maybe people would think. Yeah. I think that you can use them in a lot of different ways. They've got a lot of characteristics which can go across different cuisines and things like that.
They're definitely a big flavour enhancer, I think.
Mm. Do you ever export or sell them live?
No, only for us. It's where we're positioned. It can get quite costly.
Okay.
So if we're in Sydney, you know, it'd be quite easy. We could put them in a fish bin and take them to the Sydney fish market and the guys would sell them.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're so large. To put them in a box, you're only going to get, what, 4 urchins in a box maybe.
Mm.
And you've just paid $100 freight for... one tub by the time you spoon it all out, about a tub of urchin. Okay.
Yeah, you get a little bit of value out of sending trays and punnets
for sure. And you guys have your product available on your website for anyone to just sort of
order. Right. Yeah, yeah. So online for retail, and you can also click contact the diver, Chris.
Yeah.
And that's for wholesale.
What's your website?
SeaUrchinHarvest.com.au. Okay.
Perfect. And so, yeah, people can get on there and just buy directly from you and you can get it out there.
Yeah, and that's always expanding. We've got a marketing team now that are really working hard with us to develop new products and give people what they want. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's all sort of quite promising. Hopefully, you know, COVID-19 hasn't completely thrown a spanner in the works, but you're seeing people interested in urchins. I know a lot of chefs, and I know a lot of chefs that are more interested in urchins now than, you know, previously, like years ago. People sharing, I think with the power of social media, people sharing different preparation techniques and different cooking techniques. And when you've got more high profile chefs from maybe Sydney and things like that, using them in dishes and getting more exposure and stuff. And then, I mean, you guys have an unlimited quota on them, so you're able to upscale with demand. And it's also good for the ecosystem. So it's kind of win-win-win-win all the way down the line, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely is a triple win, we call it.
Is that what it is?
Because, like, we just employ so many people and, you know, like you said, it's good for the environment.
Yeah, so one diver can keep 10 people going all day.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so that's...
That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it sort of limits to how many divers you can have because, yeah, for every diver you need 10 people to... clean their catch.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that that's pretty fascinating, the labor that goes into it. Then you've got one diver who's doing all the harvesting, which sounds like it's the most labor intensive part. But it's one person, and then you've got another 10 that's getting it all ready to go to market.
Yeah, yeah, you think every part of it's very labor intensive.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the diver and all the way till it gets out the door.
I think that it's kind of a credit to it's a credit to people's enthusiasm for food, in a way.
Yeah,
that it's not that people are willing to go through this effort and willing to pay for you guys to go through the effort of harvesting, processing, and transporting. You know, this product.
I think that's part of the journey we've done over the 10 years, isn't it? Getting it to a viable price, because people didn't really understand that hard work. So it's sort of like working with the customer and educating them on what we do. So then they can appreciate the end result.
Mm. Yeah, cool. All right, let's get on to, you know, we'll dig into how urchins are affecting marine ecosystems. And we did talk about it just, you know, briefly before. But Rachel, do you want to give us a bit of an overview about, you know, how it works, what the difference between what an area of reef should look like as compared to what it looks like when urchins go through and that sort of thing?
So that's chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
a healthy ecosystem looks exactly how you would imagine it, you know, kelp, weed, fish, you know, beautiful. But when the urchins get in numbers that are just humongous, which is how it is right down the east coast, you end up with barrens or white rock, they call it. They just eat everything, just absolutely everything. There's nothing left except white rock.
So all the vegetation, all the algae, all the all the seaweed, all that sort of stuff gets completely destroyed by urchins.
Yeah, just all gone. And we know how important seaweed is and kelp for oxygen and just for habitat for fish. And so it is a real massive problem, the Centro sea urchin.
And, I mean, presumably, you know, at one point in time, maybe it is, maybe it's not a correct, you know, presumption, but there was some form of balance in the ecosystem where there wasn't too many urchins and everything sort of had a bit of a ecological harmony. Why do you think this proliferation has occurred, you know, in recent times?
No one can say specifically why this has occurred. It could be from overfishing of other species. Climate change is a really big factor, which I would agree with, especially with them heading right down to Tassie.
So is that with a rise in water temperatures and things like that?
Well, we're starting to notice the roe is staying fat for a lot more of the year now.
Okay.
So I don't know whether that has anything to do with the climate change possibly.
Well, it's got to be some sort of environmental factor, and I think climate change is the biggest environmental factor.
They say a lot back in the early 50s and stuff where they really fished all the big predatory snapper and stuff like that really hard and knocked the numbers way back.
Right.
And it sort of put a balance out. Like the sea urchins haven't really been fished where every other species has pretty much been fished quite hard. So I don't
Right. Because snapper and those sorts of fish eat sea urchins and
things like that, right? But they're in too big of numbers now, so the only way to sort of control them in areas is human intervention.
Yeah.
And to cull them back a bit.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about the culling program that's happening at the moment.
Yeah, so we down in the Victorian Eastern Zone, Abalone, which is around the Mallacoota area, down to Point Hicks, they go in and so they'll get maybe 10 boats and go in and just kill up to, like, kill up to 70,000 urchins in a day.
And so is this a...
it's all through...
Is it through fisheries and things like that?
Yeah, fisheries research and development.
Right.
Have organised it, and a couple of the local divers down there have sort of done all the hard work. And
right. So they contract urchin and abalone divers to get in and cull urchins?
Yeah, that's right.
So up to 70,000 in a day.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's been successful because they've targeted it so well.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do targeted areas, sort of map it out on a map, and they maybe target that area every day for a week.
And you've been a part of that, Chris?
No, not so much myself, but my brothers and stuff.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sort of always busy harvesting. So harvesting. I haven't really had time for the cull, but I've seen the areas where it's colder back, and that definitely takes them out.
Right. So there's a notable difference, like in areas.
Yeah, the kelp just comes back amazingly. They've got photos of just barren white rock and then time lapse photos of 6 months later where the kelp's 5 foot high.
Really?
And, yeah.
Six months later?
Yeah. Yeah. It grows amazingly quick when you give it a chance to come back.
Do you think that enough is being done? Is there enough culling being done? Should there be more?
Oh, there culling? Should be more. It's a mammoth task, but it's like no matter how.
Yeah, well, can you give us a bit of an idea of how big the task might be as compared to the resources available to deal with it?
Yeah, oh, it's a massive task. You could never ever get rid of them all
right
along the whole coast. There's just so many in such a big area, and they go out deep where it's too deep for divers to really spend much time there to actually cull them and stuff.
Oh, okay, right.
That's actually one of the biggest problems.
They are naturally they're. Urchin barrens have always been around naturally. You don't want to take out every urchin barren in the ocean. It's a natural part of the cycle out there.
Mm.
But, as they encroach more and more to the shallower reefs and stuff, it's good just to clear them out and give the kelp a chance to come back and grow again.
Is there anything that could be done in terms of allowing more licenses or things like that? Would the allocation of more licenses?
Not so much, because it's limited by processes and stuff, and processes are limited by sales. So if you get more processes, and then the market price drops, and it ends up being unviable sort of thing.
Mm.
But supporting the divers that are doing it is a good thing, and processing definitely helps.
Mm. What about Rachel, a bit about the marine park here, which we briefly mentioned earlier as well, but the Batemans Marine Park goes from up where's the northern tip
Brush
of it?
Brush Island. At, and
yeah, so Bawley Point.
Just south of Ulladulla. Yeah, yeah, Bawley Point.
Down to Montague Island or something like that.
Yeah, just south of Montague Island.
Yeah, so it's a pretty broad place, and it's the area in which you work. These sanctuary zones are. Why aren't, if you're doing something beneficial for the ecosystem, is there a reason why you know have you been trying to get access to areas of, you know, sanctuary zones that have been decimated by urchins and things like that?
Yeah, we've put tireless hours in writing and talking to
I actually have got access into Bawley Point.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and so since I've only been in there three times because the urchins in there have just destroyed the whole place and they're not even any good for harvest.
Mm.
And they've sort of given me set areas from their office in Sydney where I can go, but I'm finding them areas are, it's too rough. I can hardly ever get in there, and it's they've got to let me just sort of choose my own spots and that I know where the urchins are good for harvest. And
rather show the results.
Yeah, we can see the results, but they're not going to see any results at Bawley. It's just, it's so far gone there. It needs to be culled before you can get a good harvest out of there. There's a couple of little points on there, but overall it's, it's just getting decimated. And that should just all be open, because I go there now to Bawley and there's not even any fish or anything in a lot of these spots.
Mm.
I'll crack an urchin to see what the roe's like in it, and it won't even get eaten. I'll come back 5 minutes, still sitting on the bottom. Whereas I go out of the marine parks where I've been fishing hard, I crack an urchin and 1,000 fish come and eat it before I even get to look at it.
Yeah, right. And why do you think that they're only applying the culling project, you know, in these areas further south? Like, do you think that they're looking to bring...
It's sort of heavily pushed by the... It's a very big abalone industry down there.
Right.
It's worth quite a lot of money, and it was getting destroyed.
So down in Mallacoota was where it's where the heart of Australia's abalone industry is, essentially.
Yeah, that's right.
And abalone are one of the, you know, most affected animals from sea urchin proliferation.
I think a lot of people don't realise kind of what's under there. Like, there's not that many people out of the total population that actually go diving and do go to the areas that we go and stuff. And see the actual problem. It's out of sight, out of mind, I think, is a lot of the problem.
Mm.
If it was happening on land, it'd be a totally different story if people could see what actually is going on, but no one really sees.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Like, you look at, you know, conservation and things like that on land, and we talk about invasive species and the amount of resources that are put into managing them and things like that, and the way that it's in the public consciousness, it's just so far different. But if you could sort of map the scale of destruction that urchins do to the environment onto land, it's massive.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And just because it's underwater, people don't necessarily understand it.
Part of the problem is the government won't use the word pest when centro is mentioned.
Right.
They just say that it's native, which, yes, it is native, but so is crown of thorn.
Yeah.
But, you know, when things get out of control in numbers, this is what happens. The reef gets eaten out.
Do you know what? Do you have any theories as to why they won't use the word pest and you know, like, put a bit more of a firm narrative around
these creatures? Money.
Yeah,
I that's my guess. You know, if you call something a pest, then they're probably liable to actually have to then do something.
Oh, okay, right.
That's my theory. I don't know if that's true or not.
Do you see, or have you pushed for any culling projects to take place up in this area around Batemans Bay and where we are here, Browley?
They are just starting to sort of get one going a little bit further south between Eden and Bermagui.
Right.
But it's so expensive to employ divers and boats.
Mm. Because you're taking them away from what otherwise is generally quite lucrative work.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, they do have the time and stuff, but by the time you put a deckhand and a boat and one diver and they're just, the population of the urchins is just so massive, it's hard to put a dent in it. But harvesting is good helping. Like, I've really done this whole area, Browley Island, Browley Beach, Maria Heads, Pedro, Dalmeny.
Yep.
I've help that bottom in all them areas heaps.
That's great to hear. It's good to know that, you know.
I love going to these spots now. They're just like a lush garden where they were sort of really barren and stuff before, and it's just, and the life there is just comes back.
It must be a good feeling to see, you know, the tangible difference that you're making out there on the environment.
Yeah, for sure. You take 50 boxes off an area. That is quite a lot of boxes, and if you do that every day for a week, it definitely makes a difference.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's kind of better than culling too. It's leaving.
Well, it's selective, isn't it?
It's very selective. So you sort of select all the large animals, and so the small ones will stay there and grow. But just if there's less urchins per meter, then the reef gets a good chance to come back.
Yeah, cool. Anything else you wanted to mention, Rachel, about, you know, what's happening in the environment? Is there anything that you guys are looking to do in the future, or anything that the government's putting into place that you wanted to talk about before we move on?
Don't know about that one.
Yeah, I'd just like to see the marine park a bit more opened up, instead of just locking it out saying, oh yeah, that'll fix everything. They just lock it down. They don't even do any research or go there again virtually. I've never seen a boat out there checking this park. They've shut it down to everyone to be able to fish and stuff in all these areas. But really, it's just doing nothing. It's just stopping people having a good area to go and get out of the weather and be able to fish and dive and stuff. But yet the urchins in there are just destroying all the biodiversity anyhow. So
yeah, okay.
It's just pointless, especially on the inshore rocky reefs.
Yeah. I think it's a lack of money too. That's the block we come up against, isn't a lot, when we have these conversations with fisheries.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like we're not going to throw, because we're probably one of the smallest fisheries, there's no money allocated to research or let alone development.
Yeah.
So that seems to be a big barrier.
Yeah, I just like to expand and get bigger so we can get more divers going and have a bigger, more processes. And
well, it seems to be happening slowly but surely, I guess, like over the 10 years there's been a bit of a difference. And I mean, we can probably nicely segue this into how coronavirus is affecting the industry and your market and things like that. But, you know, we have seen an expansion. Hopefully, after this is all over, we have somewhat of a semblance of a vibrant restaurant industry that we had previously. Who really knows? I know that we're definitely going to lose a lot of restaurants, unfortunately, you know, from this. But yeah, how have you guys noticed, you know, coronavirus affecting your ability to sell your product?
Yeah, it's definitely had a big impact on the A grade product, which was largely to the restaurant.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It's some of the stories when it first happened were pretty sad, weren't they? Like, the fish market's telling us it's a ghost town, and just people, you know, shop owners not knowing, you know, there's no timeline, so they're really worried, how are we going to get through this? Yeah.
It's with the a lot of the private sales and that have sort of kept very steady, and I think people while they've got a lot of time at home, they're kind of still buying our product.
So for you guys, that's a really cool and sort of promising thing, I guess, that you guys are doing, is that you've managed to establish a marketplace that's not just wholesale to restaurants and to fish markets and things like that, but you've found a customer base in people that just really love urchin that want to get it directly from you.
Yeah, I think that's because of how we've based our business, which is working so closely with customers.
Yeah.
Chris, on a daily basis, will get how many text messages a day from people?
Yeah, generally about 20 a day or so.
Really?
Yeah.
What are people texting you?
They're just inquiring, and how do they go about getting it, and how do they pay and stuff
really?
Like that. And
So these are all potential new customers and things like that? Yeah. It's pretty promising, isn't it?
Yeah, they're always
like, out diving, Chris, are you diving tomorrow? You know.
Yeah. Oh, some of the feedback we get is just great too, really, really encouraging.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they just love it.
Have you noticed like, you know, are there people that are new to urchin that are getting in contact with you that are like, oh, I've heard about urchin and I want to try it. What should I do with it?
Fewer, but you do get the odd people. Like, I've got someone from Adelaide emailing me at the moment. His questions are really quite
a
bit strange.
A lot of the Kiwis and Maoris, they absolutely love it. It's like one of their traditional foods.
Yeah.
So they're like our biggest customers. If it's fresh and big and juicy, they love them.
Yeah, okay, cool. Well, I don't know. I'm trying to sort of, because I love grabbing a couple and, you know, having some. And I mean, you can just put them on toast and it's delicious, you know
what
I mean?
That is probably the most popular way with all the cultures, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Like the Kiwis will put it on, what's that bread?
Fry bread.
Fry bread. But then you see other countries, like Scandinavian countries, always like the toast or
smørbrød or something like that with like sea urchin on it. I made like this sort of sea urchin, I'm doing quote marks, but carbonara sort of situation the other night as well, which is like using sea urchin roe instead of using real eggs. And it was the simplest pasta that you can possibly make. I mean, just add a bit of garlic and salt and pepper and a bunch of sea urchin mixed through it.
Yeah.
And it's so easy and it's so delicious. So,
well, that's one of the most popular ways to have it in Italy.
Yeah.
Some chili garlic.
That's it.
You know,
yeah.
It takes 2 seconds.
So I'll put I'm gonna put a recipe for sea urchin pasta on the website and things like that. Hopefully we can just keep people aware and keep the amount of people interested in urchins growing and things like that, which will allow you guys to continue to do what you do and keep employing people down in this area that needs employment at the moment, and especially after the bushfires and especially after coronavirus now as well. So it's awesome that you guys are able to continue employing people in this area and also to continue helping this ecosystem that we have, you know, right in the ocean just next door. So
it's good, we enjoy it.
Yeah, cool. All right, it's probably a good way to end it. Guys, how can people get in touch with you and find you?
SeaUrchinHarvest.com.au.
Okay, SeaUrchinHarvest.com.au. And are you guys on Instagram, social media and things like that?
Yeah, Instagram, Facebook.
Yeah, just SeaUrchinHarvest.
Yeah, Chris's number's there. You can always contact Chris.
Yeah, find Chris's number and send him a weird text message. Yeah. I need a recipe for sea urchin ravioli, whatever it is.
Yeah, I've had a few people call and ask just about they've harvested them and what part do you eat and how do you do it? And
really?
Yeah.
Hey, you should do some sort of like online course or something like that and people can pay $5 and jump in and go, this is how you process urchin properly.
Watch out for the spikes.
Yeah, watch out for the spikes. It is a bit of a process, isn't it? But it's rewarding. I think any type of harvesting you can do it yourself and go away and eat it, it's nice and rewarding.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
cool. All right. Well, for the listeners out there, if you want to get in touch with this podcast, you can email us at thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com and find us at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram if you want to get in touch also. Guys, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming to my little place here in Browley and talking about what you do.
Thanks, Steph.
No worries. Thanks for coming.
No worries.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.